This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, we've got Congressman Charlie Rangel pushing a military draft and Fox canceling the O.J. Simpson book and TV special. That's a lot to talk about and more. So joining us today from our New York bureau is Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist at our bureau in Chicago, and from member station WRNI in Providence, Glenn Lowry, professor of the social sciences and professor of economics at Brown University. So welcome, folks. And one of the things making headlines these days is Charlie Rangel, longtime congressman, incoming chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, coming back to his push for a draft. Now, there's a question about whether or not he's saying it's absolutely necessary or whether he's doing this for political reasons. But let's take a listen to what he says.
A draft doesn't necessarily mean that everyone drafted will have to serve in the military. Having our young people commit themselves a couple of years in service to this great republic, and at the end of that, to provide some educational benefits, is the best thing for our young people and the best thing for our country.
Glenn, is this an effective form of brinksmanship? Because even his own party doesn't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole.
No, but I do think it's leadership, Farai. I mean, I don't think the draft is going anywhere as a political issue. It's a non-starter, whatever that might say about the American people. But we are at war, as the president used to be fond of reminding us, and there needs to be a sense of shared sacrifice. I mean, when President Bush decided that we were going on a crusade to establish democracy around the world, he did not go to the nation and say, it's time for all of us, to sacrifice. And that's really what I think Rangel is saying. It's not an inequality issue. It's not that there are too many poor or rich or black or brown serving. It's that if we're going to fight wars, we have to share the sacrifice. It's a civic participation issue, not an inequality issue. And I think Rangel is right to raise it, even though I don't think the draft is going anywhere.
Laura, I mean, at this point, the war is taking place on shores that are far away. Many of us, including me, know people who've served and some people don't. It's not affecting, you know, the price of milk or bread as far as most of us can see. I mean, is the invisibility of the war on the day-to-day level outside of seeing it on the television, hearing it on the radio, et cetera, is that kind of hurting a conversation about equality of service?
Well, I think there does need to be an equality of service kind of conversation. There are deep disparities in who's serving in not only in this war but in the military. Farai, and I, you know, it's not really invisible. The Vietnam War, I think the Bush administration has been better at handling the spin on this war, but you can't avoid seeing the consequences of this war if you're paying attention at all to the media. And because of the vast new opportunities we have to see video, to see individual, you know, blogging types of reports from Iraq, we don't need to rely on the networks to see the real story. I think that it really demonstrates a lack of civic engagement. Glenn mentioned the president and his lack of stepping up and making the call, but I don't see us as citizens stepping up and making the call. I think part of that is because we see how badly this war has been conducted. We see the disparities that our own troops are suffering under in terms of equipment, in terms of being sort of victims of bad strategy. So we're like, why should we go sacrifice ourselves in this really badly run war? But I also think that American citizens just aren't really, especially the wealthier citizens, aren't really willing to make those sacrifices, aren't really willing to step up and say, it's our turn.
Michael, you see a lot of African Americans, Latinos, other people of color, and even immigrants who aren't citizens. There's immigrants who are citizens, but we have non-naturalized immigrants fighting for the U.S. Army. Are we delegating too much of this war to people who may not be getting the best of American society in return?
Well, look, when you talk about this war, and what Glenn says, I have to disagree with her strongly. This is not a declaration of war. This is not a congressionally declared war. This is another undeclared war. And it's a big difference when the Congress declares war and then you have a conscription of the quote-unquote citizenry or the people in the United States to fight a legitimate war. This is an illegitimate war. This is a Bush-declared war. Moreover, there is no support. Zero support for a draft. You can forget about it. Nobody's going to be, in middle class in particular, going to, and I don't care what this whole notion of racial equality. You know, during the draft, there was no racial equality. So I don't know what Charlie Rangel was talking about. I remember there were exemptions to the draft, and there was an argument about the disproportionate number of racial minorities in the draft. And middle class had a way of trying to get out through student exemptions and other exemptions. But, you know, the other point that has to be addressed here is this notion of civic service or compulsory service. We live in a free society. People want to have a right to decide what they want to do with their lives. There's a notion of individual freedom. And, you know, I resent an interruption of my life or interruption of young people's lives to fight undeclared wars or to be conscripted into civic community service. Forget about it.
But Michael, if you carry that point out in your earlier point that folks are not going to do it, especially middle class folks that have other opportunities, what does that leave you with? It leaves you with an inadequate army. That leaves you with an unprotected front, either here or in Iraq, and it leaves you with a lot of victimization. It gets back to Farai's earlier point about the inequalities of it. My brother has been to Afghanistan and to Iraq already. He's an army lifer. He honestly did not go into the army just to do his civic duty. He went into it because he didn't have a lot of options at home.
Yeah,
and
he's for training,
and many other
skills.
People are like that. So those folks are basically just conscripted not only to not having full and equal opportunity in this country and having to go into the military service, but then likely getting shot down because of it.
They're not conscripted.
But not only is that the case, the system conscripts.
But
there's also the problem that 9/11 happened, and we live in a different world. Mm-hmm. And it is a possibility that the Persian Gulf would get closed off one of these days because the Iranians have a nuclear weapon and the Israelis do something or whatever. And this country has to be able to mobilize itself to respond to the challenges of the 21st century. And that's going to require something from everybody. And as I say,
and
it requires
what,
leadership.
And
it requires leadership.
Well, guys, let me step.
Hold on, Michael.
Let me step in for a second to what you were saying, Glenn. To be able to respond, you have to have troops. And what we're hearing from the U.S. military is that there's a great deal of debate about whether there are even enough troops to fight this war effectively. The U.S. military is not unlimited in size.
And if they raise the pay and, you know, do what they need to do, they can recruit over the long run. And we can manage with a volunteer army. I mean, that's not really the issue. It's not only troops. It's taxes and the financing of war. And it's more generally the sense of that we're all in the thing together, that the war is not just something that's on television. This is war. Rangel's other point was, he said, we'd be less likely to be at war if the sons and daughters of important people were at risk. Now, whether that's true or false, it's still a very important decision whether we go to war. It's a fundamental thing that we do as Americans. So it should involve all of us. It should not just be something that is consumed on television by people as they go on about their lives.
One further point. Young people today are still required to submit registration for a possibility of a draft, believe it or not. Now, it is up to the Congress to declare that there has to be a draft. And it is up to the Congress to declare a war. In this circumstance, Congress has not declared war, despite what Glenn says and despite what George Bush says. And Congress has not said there should be a conscription or military service through a draft.
Well,
and
tell that to the 3,000 grieving American families. Tell that to the 3,000 mothers and fathers whose sons and daughters are dead.
Come on,
one thing I've noticed, just a little time out, mm-hmm. is that our conversations keep getting more keyed up. And maybe that's a sign that this is starting to hit home a little bit more, because it's harder and harder to talk about this academically. I feel, at least on our show and probably in a lot of American homes, you know. But just to get back to one more thing before we move on, because there's another important topic I want to cover. Congressman Rangel is saying that his draft plan would include men and women ages 18 to 42. So if you thought that you blew out your knee playing tackle football, and when you were 19, that was going to get you out of it. I mean, that's a wide age range. Is it also a situation where it's going to be all hands on deck age-wise?
He's talking about compulsory service. It's not just a military draft. And this is my point. And then you've got to remember, the Democrats did not sweep to 2006 just to bring back a draft, whether it's for the military purposes to fight undeclared wars in Iran or Iraq and North Korea, whatever else. They were not elected for that purpose. And they were not elected for the purpose of depriving American citizens of their liberty. And that is the liberty to decide what I want to do with my own life. And I don't want people telling me I have to give service to government or to community. That's my decision, not Charlie Rangel's. That's why he gets no support from the Democrats or Republicans.
Somebody's going to have to fight that war.
The military has already relaxed and expanded its standards on age, on education level, even to the extent of what you should now get into the military with certain types of things on your criminal record that you couldn't before. And it gets back to the need that Glenn is pointing out. We can't afford to just limit ourselves to the volunteers that we once could get, 15, 20 years ago. And that need is going to really create some serious demands for us. If we get into something in Korea, we're just not going to be prepared.
So
all right, well, I'm going to have to cut this conversation.
No, we're not going to be prepared.
I'm going to have to give this conversation a wrap. I know we will be back to it. But meanwhile, in further exploits in American race relations, Michael Richards, who played Kramer on Seinfeld, apologized last night via satellite on the Letterman show for a tirade at a comedy club in Los Angeles on Friday. Now, we're going to play a clip of that later, but first, here is what he said at the comedy club. The language is not so great. If you got small kids around, you might want to cover their ears. Let's take a listen.
Shut up! 50 years ago, you had your own tied down with a fucking fork up your You can talk, you can talk, you can talk, you brain down with a f***er. Roll that about, he's a nigger! He's a nigger! He's a nigger!
Oh my God.
A nigger, look, he's a nigger!
All right. And then Richards, this is one of the, again, another instance of something being so widely distributed over the internet. And finally, he came on, he did another show the next night, but then he came on with his colleague Jerry Seinfeld onto Letterman last night. Let's hear a little bit of his apology.
I'm really busted up over this, and I'm very, very sorry to those people in the audience that took the brunt of that anger and hate and rage. And I'm not a racist. That's what's so insane about this. And yet it comes through. It fires out of me.
All right, Laura, I get an image. If he says, I'm not a racist, this fired out of me. I'm sort of seeing like an alien in the movie Aliens just kind of coming out of his chest. It wasn't me. It was the alien. And yeah. Then Seinfeld, his friend, said, oh, it was a mistake. So what are we to make of how he's parsing out this incident?
I am not a racist. Talk to Mel Gibson about it. Talk to every time this happens, the perpetrator, and usually it takes some time. They don't apologize right away, as he didn't. He actually came back the next night and claimed he was going to apologize and did not. This guy is a B-talent comedian who probably shouldn't have been on the stage to begin with. His colleagues have been excusing him by saying, well, he's not really a stand-up comedian. He's more of a comedic actor, and he just got a little bit carried away. I think it's something that'll blow over. It doesn't matter. And unfortunately, you heard some people in that audience laughing. And I think some of that might have been out of discomfort, but some of that is out of the fact that we use this kind of language, that we use these foul images all the time in comedy. Just turn on HBO any night and you can see the N-word repeatedly. So there's nothing new about this kind of thing. And, it's America.
Well, Michael, one thing that I read online, going around looking at how different people wrote about this was, well, black people use the N-word all the time. A white man uses it. And, why is he going to be slapped down for it?
Yeah. And I say, don't change the subject. And this is completely different. A caller to a talk radio show reminded me of that old adage, what's down in the well comes up in the bucket. This guy, Michael Richards, who played Kramer on Seinfeld, he saw the race of his heckler. That's what he saw. He saw the skin color. And then he went off into a tirade about the race of his heckler. He didn't say the A word generally. He even said 50 years ago, we'd have you upside down with an effing fork up your butt. And I just changed the language because we're on NPR. And then he started yelling, I think 12 different times, throw his A out. He's a nigger. He's a nigger. Now, this is racism. This is racist. And I don't accept the apology because I don't believe the apology. His good friend Jerry Seinfeld must have called him and said, you are in deep you-know-what. You better say something to save your career, and I don't want this stuff on me. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, he's a racist, plain and simple.
Glenn, you know, one thing that really strikes me here is that this is one of many cases. I'm thinking of all the Halloween videos of kids in blackface and in Klan costumes for Halloween on college campuses. This is a case where the ready availability of cell phone video or tiny little video cameras has kind of busted somebody. Do we think that there's more racism, or is it that people are getting busted more often?
No, I think that this incident is important. I mean, clearly what the guy did, the intent, just as Michael Myers was saying, and when he was saying it, what he meant to do was to humiliate, to abuse, to hurt in an explicitly and openly racist way. There's not any ambiguity about it. Of course it was a racist act. Now, the thing is, if he gets away with this, if he's not sanctioned, if his career isn't ended, if he's not kept from getting any other big TV deals or contracts or movies or whatever, then the implicit message will be that this is okay. You see, that the wheel has turned, that we don't have to worry about that anymore, that that's just a bunch of silly sensibilities from some old civil rights relics who have to have some axe to grind. And that's a sign of a kind of creeping, slow drift in the sensibility of American values that should be very disturbing. Now, I find it ironical that this happens at the same time that this O.J. Simpson thing goes down. And I'm not equating O.J.'s possibly killing those people to this guy saying something racist. But what I'm saying is that the power of informal social sanction cannot be underestimated. Now, O.J. was acquitted, but the fact is that he suffers now. He suffers because people won't deal with him because they think him despicable. This guy is despicable. What he did is despicable. If he's not made to suffer for it, it's telling us something about America.
Maybe in 10 years, Michael Richards can write a book, If I Said It.
That's right, If I Said It. All right, on that note, I'm going to let you guys go. Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Glenn Lowry, Professor of the Social Sciences and Professor of Economics at Brown University. Thank you guys so much.
Thank
you're
you.
Welcome.